You are listening to Aldo Leopold and the Emerging Land Ethic. For the Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler. Aldo Leopold was born in 1887 and died in 1948. From 1909 till 1924, he lived and worked in the forest regions of the American Southwest before moving to Wisconsin to teach at the university and to spend his free time at the Shack, his home away from home. Over the next hour, we'll listen to many voices of those who have been influenced by Aldo Leopold, whose masterpiece, A Sand County Almanac, is regarded as one of America's finest contributions to world literature. Author Susan Flouder is a noted environmental historian who has looked deeply into the life and heritage of Aldo Leopold.
Aldo Leopold was born in 1887 in Burlington, Iowa. Grew up there in a house overlooking the Mississippi River. Leopold had decided that he wanted to go to the brand new Yale Forest School. Spent a year and a half at the Lawrenceville School in New Jersey, and then entered Yale University. So he graduated in 1909 with a Master of Forestry and had only one goal in mind, which was to join the U.S. Forest Service. The service had been established in 1905, and his goal in life was to become a forest supervisor. He was assigned to the Southwestern District of the Forest Service and went out to Albuquerque in July 1909 to begin his first job on the Apache National Forest in Arizona Territory. Statehood would be several years off. That was where he became attached incredibly to the landscape of the Southwest. 2 years later, he was called back to Albuquerque to be reassigned to a different forest. He met Estella Bergere on that trip while he was in Albuquerque for a short time, and then was assigned to the Carson National Forest in northern New Mexico. After about a year, he became the acting and then finally the official forest supervisor. By the time he was 25 years old, he had achieved his life's ambition to be a forest supervisor. That was a forest that was a very multicultural forest. He was dealing with Jicarilla, Apache Indians, with Hispanos, with Pueblo people, the Taos, as well as with Anglos, who were trying to wrest away the lands of the native peoples. And it was an extremely challenging assignment.
Enrique Lambadrid is a professor at the University of New Mexico and one of America's greatly respected folklorists.
Aldo Leopold's relationship to New Mexico goes way, way beyond the landscapes and into the human landscapes and history of this place. Aldo Leopold's wife was Estella Bergere Luna. Estella Bergere Luna was part of the Luna clan. She was a Nueva Mexicana. She was what we call a Coyota, a person of mixed cultural heritage.
Estella Leopold is the youngest of the children of Aldo and Estelle Bergere Leopold. She is a distinguished paleobotanist, now emeritus at the University of Washington, and a fine folk musician whose Leopold family repertoire includes many Hispanic folk songs of New Mexico.
But he was sick for 2 years flat after he had ridden across a pass, and a snowstorm fell on him, and his bedroll and everything was wet, and he had to sleep in a wet bedroll for a couple of nights. By the time he made it to mother, to home, he had a bad kidney infection or condition, and it knocked him out for a couple of years. It was terrible. By that point, I guess he went back down and took some administrative jobs in the Forest Service in Albuquerque.
Leopold took a position with the Albuquerque Chamber of Commerce. He was actually the first paid executive secretary of the Albuquerque Chamber of Commerce. That lasted until after the war in 1919, when he applied to return to the Forest Service and was made assistant regional forester in charge of operations, roads, trails, personnel, fire control on 20 million acres of national forest in the Southwest. It was during that period that he conducted a lot of inspections of forests that he had known when he first came to the Southwest in 1910, and noticed the incredible differences, especially the erosion in mountain valleys, and became so interested in the forested watersheds of the Southwest and what could be done to maintain or restore their integrity. And I have always believed that it was out of that concern for the watersheds of the Southwest that he developed his land ethic philosophy.
Courtney White is the director of the Quivira Coalition and author of Revolution on the Range, The Rise of a New Ranch in the American West.
After he got sick and was reassigned to the regional office, they sent him on tours of national forests, really to study the resource, and particularly a couple forests in Arizona, the Prescott, where he saw a tremendous gullying, a deep arroyos in these landscapes that he suspected were not natural, as he was taught or told that these were natural. And he began to make these connections between grass and soil and rain and slope and overgrazing, principally by cattle. He wasn't anti-grazing, but he certainly was anti-bad management. And then he went to the Blue River Range, and he saw the whole valley bottom washed out, and he began to write. In fact, he wrote an amazing essay called Pioneers and Gullies, published in Sunset Magazine, of all places, one of the popular magazines, 1924, where he decries the pioneer attitude towards land and how they just had come in, taken a European kind of way of living in a wetter environment with a certain kinds of agricultural practices, put it in an environment that he called a hair-trigger ecological environment, meaning the desert Southwest, and not understood the effects when those two things came together. Too many cows, not managed. So then he started drawing lines between dots, between overgrazing, poor timber management, and then soil loss. And then he starts writing about when you lose soil, you begin to destabilize literally the foundation of civilization, because everything's, once you lose soil, you're losing everything. And he writes constantly for the rest of his life about this experience.
As you are aware, Dad had been publishing essays that became eventually rewritten or edited chapters in this book of his, San County Almanac, for years. And he started out in the 20s writing conservation essays. But the chief elements of the book, which is an almanac, came from the Leopold Shack, where he was describing how it was in February and how it was in March and the birds. And he had these perfectly darling descriptions of the wildlife, along with the characteristics of the land, the restored land at our shack. And it made, then he put at the end of this book, in the 40s, he was working on putting these together and had Charlie Schwartz do the artwork, which is his favorite artist from University of Missouri. Well, Jefferson City, Missouri. And sent it to the Alfred Knopf, who turned it down. And then I don't know where else it went, but when it went to the Oxford Press, they accepted it. And that was in 1948 in the spring. And we heard that news. He got the news just before we went up to the shack, which was his last trip. So it was wonderful that he knew that his book was going to be published.
Early in his adulthood, Leopold read Tertium Organum by Russian philosopher P. D. Uspensky, wherein his sense of the spirit of a place, or even the whole planet, was reinforced.
There is another concept that he got from Uspensky, although he never credits Uspensky directly with it. It's the concept of the noumenon, as distinct from the phenomenon being the outward manifestation, what you can easily see and understand, and the noumenon being the inner meaning, the essence of something. One of the first times that he wrote about it was actually in another unpublished manuscript. He was writing a book on southwestern game fields. In one of the early chapters, he writes about deer as the noumenon of the southwestern mountains. He says, without the presence of deer, or the possibility of seeing a deer at each new dip and bend of the hillside, the Southwest would be empty, a spiritual vacuum. The deer he saw as the noumenon of the southwestern mountains. Well, years later, he certainly would not have thought of deer as the noumenon of the mountains, especially when he spent so much time dealing with problems of overpopulation of deer and the damage that they were causing to other resources. In later years, obviously, it would have been the wolf that was the noumenon of the southwestern mountains. You know, it wasn't a new concept to him, I don't believe. I think it was a new philosophical term for something that he already intuitively felt, because he obviously thrilled to the howl of the wolf back when he was on the Apache and the Carson National Forest.
Nina Leopold Bradley is the elder daughter of Aldo and Estella Leopold. She is 91 years old and had just returned from cross-country skiing in time to be interviewed.
I could say that he is the most religious person I ever knew, and he never went inside of a church. He knew right from wrong. He lived his life ethically. He, didn't need the guidance of a deity. The years as we were growing up, I got to know him the best because we all worked together, we all played together. He was awesome in lots of ways. He was always teaching us, but never did you know he was teaching us. If you asked him a question, then he would just do everything to try to draw you out and make you think. But he never said, this is a so-and-so, and you should understand that it is related to the things next to it. He was very subtle in the way he taught.
Well, he was a gentle, wonderful father, kind of a little on the formal side in town. But when we were in the country, he was just loads of fun and full of jokes and very clever guy. Very good at field cooking, by the way. With his hands, he was a great craftsman. He made all the bows and arrows, which we all shot with. Mother became a winner. I think she won the state of Wisconsin first place archery placement for 5 years in a row or something. And she placed in the national. You know, she was amazing. So Dad made very good equipment, you see. Well, he was just a wonderful, warm person with, and actually kind of sentimental. Every once in a while that would show. And very good at helping us. When we were in the field on a walk or something, he would make leading questions like, how do you explain that track? What do you think that was? What happened here? And then, you know, who's been browsing this bush today? So what are the deer eating this week? You know, that kind of thing. Estella, look at that island over there. Why is it the trees on the upper end of the island are bigger than the ones on the bottom end? And I had to think about that one for a while. You know, finally figured it out. But anyway, that's the kind of guy he was. He was a Socratic teacher, really. Very good. Mom was wonderful. Very supportive, of course. And they were very, very close. Dad came home every noon for lunch and walk in the door, and Mother would greet him with her apron on, and they would hug, and he would say, Estella, the house looks so beautiful. How do you do it? And sit down and have lunch and hold hands. You know, it was just great. They were very warm, and she was, of course, very supportive. Mother was a pianist, a musician at heart, but just sotto voce. She didn't make much of it.
He had a wonderful sense of humor. There was never any small talk around Dad. It was always very, very serious. But if something really captured him, he would just dissolve. I remember one time my sister was late in arriving at the shack. We were all there for the weekend. So she took the train and her bicycle and her pet squirrel, and took the train to Baraboo and then rode her bike into the edge of the marsh. And then she had to swim across the marsh. My father and I just happened to be out taking a walk, and Dad saw this creature coming along with a squirrel on her head, and I thought he was going to collapse in laughter. He just absolutely broke down. He had a wonderful sense of humor.
Well, you know, we were all going to the Leopold Shack, Dad's little country place, ever since I was 8 years old, and we used to go almost every weekend. And I said almost. It was literally every weekend Dad could afford to get away, like he didn't have a talk in Milwaukee or something. And so we spent a lot of time outdoors, and it was very easy for all of us children to get into some kind of natural sciences. Starker had gotten into wildlife shooting right after Dad's footprints. Luna into hydrology and erosion problems. Nina in geography. Carl in botany. Then came me. And I became a botanist. Kind of a funny story. I was quite young, and Dad said something about, what do you think you want to do when you grow up? I said, well, I want to be a bugologist. I want to study bugs. And he said, why is that? Well, he said, I said, everything else is taken. Yeah. Well, he said, let's go down to the bookstore on Monday, and I'll get you a plant book and see what you can do with that, which is what he did, and it worked.
William DeBuys is himself a fine author and environmental activist whose thinking and writing have been greatly influenced by Aldo Leopold.
One of the things that I think he glimpsed that is now sort of a cornerstone of ecological thinking is the idea of energy flow through land, of water moving, of air moving, of nutrients moving, and so forth. And he had this vision, this integrated holistic vision of the flows through the ecosystem. And they took place often within the watershed unit. And so he saw the watershed as being a primary unit for land management and even more for land understanding. It's interesting to me that he passed so much of this attentiveness along to Luna Leopold. Susan Flott told me that Leopold had written a long essay of some kind about the impact of grazing on arroyo cutting. And he was very concerned with the integrity of watersheds and saw the cutting of arroyos as being, in a sense, a mortal sin against the landscape because it does so much long-term damage, lowering the water table and increasing the pulse of erosion down into downstream watercourses and so forth. Well, Leopold saw that human uses of the land, trailing cattle, building wagon roads, grazing cattle, etc., contributed a lot to arroyo cutting, and so he wrote about this connection. And he sent this essay to a professor at Harvard, Kirk Bryan, who was a very important geologist at that time and had done a lot of work at Chaco Canyon and other places. And Bryan was of a different school. Bryan believed that arroyo cutting in the Southwest was subject to sort of geological cycles and that people might be able to speed up those cycles, but that the cycles were essentially weather or climate driven and geologically driven. So Bryan disagreed with Leopold, evidently, enough so that Leopold never published this piece of work and never quite resolved this issue of human cause versus geologic and climate cause of arroyo cutting. But, according to Susan, he encouraged his son, Luna Leopold, to go to Harvard and study with Kirk Bryan and see if he could get to the bottom of this. And Luna Leopold became one of the great hydrologists in the history of the science in North America and did indeed spend a lot of time working on this and finally came around to the compromise position, actually, between his father and between his professor, saying that he believed that, yes, arroyo cutting does follow geological and climatic cycles, but that human beings, with their activities, can take 50 years of natural arroyo cutting and compress it into 10, speed it up. One of the things I take away from this is the intellectual integrity of that whole Leopold family that, in a sense, pressing questions might be sent down over generations, and people keep working on it. I think that's kind of fascinating. Not many families will do that.
In 1922, Aldo Leopold submitted a formal proposal that part of the Gila National Forest of southern New Mexico be administered as a wilderness area off limits to vehicular traffic, mining, timbering, and heavy machinery. His proposal was accepted by the National Forest Service in 1924, and thus the Gila Wilderness became the first such wilderness area in the United States. 40 years later, the Wilderness Act was passed into federal law. The passage of this occurred on the watch of Stuart Udall during his tenure as Secretary of the Interior.
Clinton Anderson was an insurance man in Albuquerque, and he and Leopold became friends. I think this is probably in the early 1920s in Albuquerque. They used to discuss the national forests, and Leopold convinced Anderson that the wilderness bill was a good idea and there should be a law protecting wilderness. Anderson became a congressman, and he was a buddy, by the way, of Harry Truman, who used to play in the poker group. Anderson became a senator in 1948, and he became chairman of the committee in 1960, right after Kennedy was elected. He went to the White House, and he told Kennedy to sponsor a wilderness bill, and he handed him a copy of his bill, Senate Bill 5. He said, call for the enactment of a wilderness bill. Kennedy agreed and put it in his conservation message, and that led directly, and with Anderson having a lot of other sponsors, Lyndon Johnson signed it into law, I think in September 1964.
Again, Nina Leopold Bradley.
One of my father's students, Albert Hochbaum, was supposed to do the illustrations for a Sand County Almanac. And as Dad was accumulating the essays, he said to my father, Aldo, you weren't always right about everything. You had your ideas changed, and you have to admit that you used to kill predators. He was kind of rough about it. Dad was a very sensitive person. So that, I think, is when Dad decided to write Thinking Like a Mountain, that he did change his mind as he had more information. He finally wrote Thinking Like a Mountain, sent it to Albert, and Albert was overjoyed.
Again, William DeBuis.
He wrote Thinking Like a Mountain in the spring of 1944. And so the best that his biographers have been able to figure is that the incident with the wolf, if it occurred, and probably it did occur, it probably occurred in 1909. That's what, 35 years earlier. And he speaks of this deeply moving epiphany he experienced of watching the green fire die in the wolf's eyes and realizing that he needed to think more like a mountain, that fewer wolves and more deer didn't necessarily mean a better world, that the wolf had a place in the world, that all the creatures in the world had a place in the life of the mountain, and that that was the mountain's point of view. This was a deep environmental conservationist epiphany. And yet, that was 1909. In 1920, he was still speaking to national conferences of game managers saying, we need to exterminate every single wolf and cougar remaining in New Mexico, and until we do that, the job of game management won't be done. So we have a conflict here. On the one hand, he speaks of an epiphany that he had in 1909 from the perspective of 1944. On the other hand, we have this hard evidence that in 1920, he wasn't exhibiting the wisdom of that epiphany. What conclusion can we draw? Well, to make a long story short, the fact is, as a great storyteller, Leopold had taken a lifetime of learning and compressed it into one small literary moment that makes a great story. But in fact, the real growth the man experienced was slow and incremental and continued over all those 35 years from 1909 to 1944 when he wrote the essay. And he, like all the rest of us, acquired what wisdom he acquired in bits and pieces, dribs and drabs over time. It didn't come in a single bolt of lightning. His life, for my money, gives us a better example of continuous learning, of being the perpetual student, of living alertly, of paying attention to the signals around you all the time, and acquiring wisdom incrementally, gradually, over the whole of one's life, not just having a single epiphany when you're 22 and then you know it.